Alto Adige Cultura. Appuntamento di approfondimento, attualità, cultura e pubblica utilità promosso dalla Ripartizione Cultura Italiana della provincia di Bolzano.
Un caloroso benvenuto a tutti gli ascoltatori del podcast Alto Adige Cultura per la terza ed ultima parte della registrazione della conferenza Missione Possibile, capire l'arte. L'intervento viene proposto interamente in inglese per via del divieto di registrazione della traccia audio della traduzione simultanea. Buon ascolto.
As Francesco mentioned, the goal of the exhibition in many ways was to open up the interpretation of contemporary art by applying one discipline, anthropology, to another very different discipline, contemporary art. We weren't setting out to make the visitor think that they were really on Mars. They were certainly aware that it was a fictional construction. In many ways, the Barbican lent itself to enhancing the kind of visitor's experience of looking at the works of contemporary art. In this first image here, it's the entrance to the Martian Museum. And in the Barbican has a kind of a utopian look of from a 1960s design aspect. There's a coffered ceiling with kind of rounded coffers, and then there's this big staircase that descends from the first story to the ground floor, and it almost looks like as if a spaceship has opened up and a passageway for the visitor to enter is there and invites the visitor into this gallery that looks very much like the interior of a spacecraft. It was a very important for us not to convince the visitor that they were on Mars, but really to convince them that it was a museum exhibition of a very different sort. And we worked very closely in collaboration with a graphic designer named Sarah DeBond and an exhibition designer named Jamie Fobert to create a special look and a structure for the interpretation of the work in the exhibition. So Francesco mentioned that this sort of monolithic structure at the entrance is actually the introductory wall text. And our graphic designer, Sarah DeBond, designed a special font. She was very much working with the existing font that the Barbican uses. The font we use at the Barbican is Futura SB, which is a common font, sans serif. And she designed a font called Futura ET, like Futura Extraterrestrial. And she took the alphabet and applied symbols to it and came up with this font, which I can see that it looks like you're already very familiar with this language here, and you've been quite fluent in it. So the other thing that the introductory panel signals is these different categories. Here you can see these copper strips that announce the four main categories, and they lead to the subsection panels, section panels and then subsection panels. So it was a way of organizing the categories which we divided the museum into in a kind of map that resembled a computer circuit board. Exhibition designer thought of it as sort of a motherboard leading to the circuits leading to smaller other boards that would then signal other pieces of information. In addition to the graphics and the design, we also worked closely with an audio guide company called Antenna Audio. One thing that we really wanted to do with the exhibition was to maintain the traditional conventions of museum display and interpretation. So interpretation is very important to this exhibition, and one thing that we originally conceived very early on was to have an audio guide. This is a traditional interpretation tool many museums use to provide a historical overview that complements the written material of the exhibition. So I'm going to play you the introduction to it to give you an idea. And one of the things that we debated very early on when we decided to do this audio guide is what sort of voice did we want to narrate the audio guide. Some people suggested maybe you should have someone like Laurie Anderson, who uses a kind of voice coder that changes the tone of her voice and makes it very sort of foreign sounding. And other people thought maybe it's better to have a much more kind of traditional voice that you would hear on a regular audio guide anyways. Ultimately, we decided to pick a very kind of proper English voice, somebody that sounded like a museum director. So we weren't trying to convince the listener that he was really a Martian or he was from outer space, but that he came to the subject with a lot of authority, with his both idea of opening the collection of the museum to a public and introducing it to a broad audience, but also conveying new knowledge.
Welcome to the Martian Museum of Terrestrial Art. My name is Dr. Klaatu, and as the director of the museum, I'm delighted to be guiding you through this, the inaugural display of our collection. Go straight in and take a look around. We're well aware of the huge sense of anticipation this exhibition has generated, but rest assured, these curious artifacts will not only astonish and fascinate, but also fundamentally alter our perception of Earthlings. Over the past three cycles, we have been collecting and cataloguing mysterious objects from the planet known as Terra. Terrestrials themselves refer to these objects as art. Art, and in particular contemporary art, appears to have a profound significance for Earthlings and provokes extreme reactions. We have witnessed terrestrials apparently lost in reverence, but also observed others vibrate in shock or revulsion. This presentation aims to interrogate the human notion of art. To do so, my staff have organized the collection into four categories: kinship and descent, magic and belief, ritual, and communication, with each category being further divided into subsections.
So that gives you a little bit of a flavor of the director of the museum and the kind of tone he takes, which is quite a didactic one. So returning to some of our other the ways we organized our exhibition, Francesco had mentioned that the sections and then each of the sections being divided into subsections. So you can see that leading from that main green introductory text, each of the strips goes to one of these black subcategory texts, which reflect the four main subcategories, and then each of the subcategories, this one being kinship and descent, leads into the subsections, and this is the ancestor worship one. Another important strategy for us was to think about how museums typically displayed objects. We went to a number of anthropology museums in the UK, namely the Horniman Museum, which is an anthropology museum in South London, and also one in Oxford that had, it's called Pitt Rivers, and it maintains a very traditional display. And this idea of having many, many examples of one type of object, we felt that this was a strategy that was quite different if you compare it to contemporary art, where the contemporary art object is usually isolated. It's on a wall, often by itself, or on a platform. There's a clean presentation. There's no other clutter, visual clutter around it. This is meant to enhance our idea of contemplating the object. When we looked at these anthropology museums, there was quite a contrast. There was often quite a jumble of many types of one object, maybe 20, 30 examples in a very crowded case that may have been poorly lit. So our exhibition designer wanted to find ways of clustering objects in the exhibition. So he made use of a lot of plinths, this kind of low pedestal that grouped together, for example, here, these four totems. And the objects are quite different. Two of them, or three of them, are quite contemporary works. On the left, there's the sculpture by Matthew Monahan in the foreground of a young artist of Colombian and German descent living in London named Tatiana Echevarria Fernandez. The work on the far right is a recent work by Isa Genskin, the German sculptor. And then in the back, an earlier work by James Lee Byers, an American artist. And each of these objects would have a very different connotation, ranging from perhaps mystical to more formal to others that, like the Tatiana Echevarria Fernandez sculpture, the black one in the front, have a more specific content. But we by bringing them together in this way, we're hoping that people, our visitors, would look at them and perhaps not think of the traditional interpretations, but maybe bring a new perspective, kind of fresh eyes, to the exploration of contemporary art. In a similar manner, objects on the wall were clustered together, as in this, it's from the section on rituals, and these are all mask-like objects. Some of them are literally masks or meant to be masks. Others are items from performances, like the one on the upper right-hand corner. And others are two-dimensional collaged items that incorporate perhaps the face, but also elements that obscure or alter the face. And we put them together in this display vitrine, clustered together very much like you would see in an anthropology collection. As I mentioned, collaboration was a very important element in putting together the exhibition, particularly when we got to the point of actually thinking about how to mount it. And one of the things that inspired us was our graphic designer, when she came to do a pitch for us, to pitch for the job, she brought a number of different images to the presentation. And one of the images was a little museum display with a sign that said the object had been removed for perhaps conservation reasons. So when we didn't get a very important loan at the last minute, it was a sculpture by Paul Tech, because of conservation reasons, we took her idea and put in the back corner. There's a label identifying the artwork as if it should be there, but then there's like a conservator's report explaining that it had been removed for conservation or other reasons. So it was a way of being able to include the presence of a work, but without actually having it physically in the gallery, and at the same time miming the conventions of that museums use. Just as the exhibition used many traditional tropes of the museum in terms of display and interpretation, our graphic designer did similar things with the book. So she not only considered the book a catalog of the exhibition, but she called it an encyclopedia of terrestrial art. And the idea was that it came from a larger series of a Martian encyclopedia of terrestrial life. And on the left-hand page, you see a number of volumes, kind of fictional volumes of previous and future subjects, volume eight being art. And one of the great things that happened more recently, after the exhibition closed, somebody wrote to us asking, when is volume nine coming out? So we very much appreciated that occasionally there would be people who would step out of the reality and join our fiction. Another strategy that we used both in the book but also in the free brochure that each visitor received was including a floor plan. Most museums, when you go, you get a guide to the collections, and this is very much not only helping you understand how the collection is organized, but if you're a visitor and you specifically are interested in masks, you could go to the second floor and see the section devoted to masks. So it is very much kind of in keeping with the ways museums organize their information. And then sections of the book replicated the traditional kind of interpretation of objects from a museum collection. So the Francesco and I and our assistant curator, Corinna Gardner, each of us took turns writing some of these interpretive entries. So this is a work by Damien Hirst. It's a group of fish suspended in formaldehyde cases. And the interesting thing about this piece was that all the fish were swimming in the same direction. So wearing our Martian anthropologist research hat, we interpreted the work as being a sort of a ritual or kind of a very much along the lines that you would see in early cave drawings, like in Lascaux, for example, where all the animals might be moving in the same direction. So we thought that maybe this was a way that the artist was trying to control a certain magic act to happen. Maybe he was wishing for a successful hunt, or he was wishing to be kind of for intellectual acumen or some sort of special power, and using the fish to try to bring about this magic act. Another example of this sort of interpretation is this work by Ian Hamilton Finley. We considered it a curse, and in many ways it was already a curse. Ian Hamilton Finley was in a dispute with his local Scottish council over, I think, a property issue, and he made this print that said "Death to the Strathclyde region" with a guillotine blade. So in some ways he was secretly hoping that the local council would die or fail or something, and then he would be able to do what he wanted with his piece of property. So in some cases, the interpretation really wasn't that far from the artwork. We were maybe just taking it one step further to kind of either make an ironic point or sometimes making it a little absurd so the viewer would perhaps feel free to interject their own ideas. Another strategy of interpretation that was used both in the book but also in throughout the exhibition was the use of drawings. In a kind of anthropology museum, you might see illustrations that might show how an object would have functioned in its original context. So our graphic designer worked with a French illustrator who came up with these drawings, imagining how the different artworks may have functioned on planet Earth. So this one, a sculpture by Manfred Pernice, he imagined that the spirit of Pablo Picasso would be rising from the chimney because the watercolor on the front depicts the Paris neighborhood that Picasso resided in during the early 20th century. Or this work by Joseph Boyce called Capri Battery. Perhaps the battery was actually the light bulb, the yellow light bulb, which grew on a tree that specifically produced Capri batteries. This is a work by the American artist Hans Steinbach, and we viewed it as an altar. Our illustrator came up with this drawing of like a little home altar with candles and the bust of C-3PO, who was like the godlike figure resting on the home altar, and there would be a candle to light every night for C-3PO. From the exchange section of the exhibition, we have this illustration of two, they sort of look like Mao Zedong and perhaps an American diplomat from the 1970s exchanging gifts. One of the gifts was a Coke bottle from the work of Sildo Morales on the left, and the other one was Christo's, a wrapped package. So these were objects that we viewed as possible objects of exchange that humans might exchange in some sort of ritual fashion, and he illustrated by showing these two figures trading the objects. I'm going to return to the audio guide as it was also a very important interpretive tool for us and play you a few extracts in which the narrator talks about specific works from the exhibition. Not sure if I can keep the image up at the same time, or maybe we can play and then...
Chom's urinal was an ordinary artifact made from a rough porcelain. And though this piece superficially looks similar, it's cast in a precious metal and painstakingly polished. It is, in fact, a sculpture made using traditional art methods, the opposite of Duchamp's fountain.
We're going to go on to the next work. It's a work by the California artist Jeffrey Valens. It takes the form of a holy shroud devoted to a pet hen that actually was a frozen supermarket chicken that the artist created a very special burial ceremony in one of the most famous Los Angeles pet cemeteries.
This holy relic venerates Blinky, the friendly hen. But what is Blinky, and why did her cult arise? The story of her path to adoration might provide an answer. Ras Tavas, one of our covert operatives, was in the field and able to witness the birth of a human god.
Blinky's owner was Jeffrey Valens, who bought Blinky from a supermarket. As she was already dead, Valens organized to have her buried in one of Los Angeles' most exclusive and expensive pet cemeteries, complete with satin-lined coffin and smartly dressed pallbearers. Naturally, before the ceremony, Valens took photos of the headless, oven-ready deity. This was when he discovered a perfect impression of the bird, made from its own bodily fluids, imprinted on the paper on which he'd rested. This was perhaps Blinky's first miracle.
And we see an image of this shroud at the centre of the work. At the bottom right-hand corner, you'll notice that there's another shroud, the Shroud of Turin, a highly revered relic, also believed to bear the indexical impression of an important deity, and which also reveals itself in negative photographs. Perhaps it is placed in this work as a comparison to Blinky, or perhaps because Valens believes the Blinky shroud has a similar status. Since Blinky's funeral 30 Earth years ago, her cult has grown. The original shroud was, like many revered relics, sold for a large sum of money. Blinky's story has been told on video, in newspapers and on television shows, and relics such as this have toured the earth.
So this work here is the one you saw illustrated in an earlier drawing that was being exchanged by the two political figures. It's a work by Sildo Morales, the Brazilian artist, and it's a series of Coke bottles on which he's imprinted different messages and then put back into circulation. So he would then return them to the store for the unsuspecting viewer to, or the unsuspecting consumer to purchase, and then perhaps they would notice these strange messages on the bottle.
Most human exchanges reinforce social relationships in some way. Though there is a perceived giver and receiver, the transaction is nearly always reciprocal, designed to establish an ongoing cycle of exchange that forms the foundation of human society. The drink bottles in front of you partook in a fascinating cycle of exchange that occurred in a land called Brazil in the early 1970s. Observed by our covert agent, they challenged our very notions of the human gift.
In Brazil at this time, inhabitants bought a bottled drink called Coca-Cola, enjoyed the gift of sugary liquid contained within, then presented the bottle back to its maker, both as a token of appreciation and for reuse, so the cycle could begin again. But a terrestrial named Sildo Morales disturbed this cycle. Rather than returning the bottles in their original state, he altered their decoration so the bottles displayed new messages. For example, Yankees go home. Now, we'd previously thought that all exchanges reinforced social cohesion, and we were confused by an act that threatened instability. For though the cycle continued, the drinker now received sugar water with a new additive, ideas. Why did he do this? To destabilize a multinational economic circuit or to improve the intellectual quality of carbonated beverages? And how does giving instructions on transforming the bottle into an explosive device, a Molotov cocktail, aid the nature of the exchange? We were also baffled by the purpose of an apparently anonymous gift, a gift that interacted with a society that had no knowledge of his involvement, and thus with no possibility of direct reciprocation.
This mystery may now have been solved. Many of his artistic community at the time faced persecution from the authorities.
So the strategy with which we ended our exhibition was to have a small room that initially looked like it's some sort of storage area, like a kind of a makeshift area in a museum that you weren't really supposed to look at. It contained a number of empty crates that were kind of piled up in the corner. And it also included a little office. The viewers could look in the office, and it was the Department of Unclassified Objects. So this was a way for us to open up a number of objects for interpretation on the viewer's part. We selected about a half a dozen objects that we thought were very interesting, but we didn't know quite where to put them within our taxonomic structure. They didn't quite fit in one category or the next, but they somehow were very intriguing to us. So we made a little room that looked like either an office or something between an office and a storage space. There was a table inside, and on the table you could see these various objects. The table had some sort of archival fabric on the table, and then each of the objects were laid out as if they were recent acquisitions, things that the Martian anthropologists had just recently brought back from a mission to Earth. They included objects that we hadn't quite resolved how to interpret ourselves. So we made this little room, and then we also put kind of labels, like perhaps a kind of a condition report or a tag identifying the object, and it was written in the Martian text that our graphic designer came up with. And this was a way for the viewers to kind of end their visit to the Martian Museum and ponder these objects and maybe think about what kind of ideas or modes of interpretations or how they would approach these objects in this kind of open-ended context. So that gives you an idea about how we employed a lot of different museum display and interpretation strategies and very much kept to the model in some ways of a traditional museum. Thank you.
Abbiamo trasmesso Alto Adige Cultura, appuntamento di approfondimento, attualità, cultura e pubblica utilità.